Chapter 32. Remained in it. His real detachment from her had taken place, not at the lurid moment of disenchantment, but now, in the sober afterlight of discrimination, where he saw her definitely divided from him by the crudeness of a choice which seemed to deny the very differences he felt in her. It was before him again in its completeness, the choice in which he was content to rest. In the stupid costliness of the food, and the showy dullness of the talk, in the freedom of speech which never arrived at wit, and the freedom of act which never made for romance. The strident setting of the restaurant, in which their table seemed set apart in a special glare of publicity, and the presence added of little Dabham of the Evira notes, emphasized the ideals of a world where conspicuousness passed for distinction, and the society column had become the role of fame. It was as the immortalizer of such occasions that little Dabham, wedged in modest watchfulness between two brilliant neighbors, suddenly became the center of Selden's scrutiny. How much did he know of what was going on, and how much, for his purpose, was still worth finding out? His little eyes were like tentacles thrown out to catch the floating intimations with which, to Selden, the air at moments seemed thick. Then again it cleared to its normal emptiness, and he could see nothing in it for the journalist, but leisure to note the elegance of the ladies' gowns. Mrs. Dorset's, in particular, challenged all the wealth of Mr. Dabham's vocabulary. It had surprises and subtleties worthy of what he would have called the literary style. At first, as Selden had noticed, it had been almost too preoccupying to its wearer. But now she was in full command of it, and was even producing her effects with unwonted freedom. Was she not, indeed, too free, too fluent, for perfect naturalness? And was not Dorset, to whom his glance had passed by a natural transition, too jerkily wavering between the same extremes? Dorset indeed was always jerky, but it seemed to Selden that tonight each vibration swung him farther from his center. The dinner, meanwhile, was moving to its triumphant close, to the evident satisfaction of Mrs. Bry, who, throned in apoplectic majesty between Lord Skiddaw and Lord Hubert, seemed in spirit to be calling on Mrs. Fisher to witness her achievement. Short of Mrs. Fisher, her audience might have been called complete, for the restaurant was crowded with persons mainly gathered there for the purpose of spectatorship, and accurately posted as to the names and faces of the celebrities they had come to see. Mrs. Bry, conscious that all her feminine guests came under that heading, and that each one looked her part to admiration, shone on Lily with all the pent-up gratitude that Mrs. Fisher had failed to deserve. Selden, catching the glance, wondered what part Miss Bart had played in organizing the entertainment. She did, at least, a great deal to adorn it, and as he watched the bright security with which she bore herself, he smiled to think that he should have fancied her in need of help. Never had she appeared more serenely mistress of the situation than when, at the moment of dispersal, detaching herself a little from the group about the table, she turned with a smile and a graceful slant of the shoulders to receive her cloak from Dorset. The dinner had been protracted over Mr. Bry's exceptional cigars and a bewildering array of liqueurs, and many of the other tables were empty. But a sufficient number of diners still lingered to give relief to the leave-taking of Mrs. Bry's distinguished guests. The ceremony was drawn out and complicated by the fact that it involved, on the part of the Duchess and Lady Skiddaw, definite farewells, and pledges of speedy reunion in Paris, where they were to pause, and REP 226 greater than plenish their wardrobes on the way to England. The quality of Mrs. Bry's hospitality, and of the tips her husband had presumably imparted, lent to the manner of the English ladies a general effusiveness which shed the rosiest light over their hostess's future. In its glow, Mrs. Dorset and the Stepneys were also visibly included, and the whole scene had touches of intimacy worth their weight in gold to the watchful pen of Mr. Dabham. A glance at her watch caused the Duchess, to exclaim to her sister that they had just time to dash for their train, and the flurry of this departure over, the Stepneys, who had their motor at the door, offered to convey the Dorsets and Miss Bart to the quay. The offer was accepted, and Mrs. Dorset moved away with her husband in attendance. Miss Bart had lingered for a last word with Lord Hubert and Stepney, on whom Mr. Bry was pressing a final, and still more expensive, cigar, called out Colin, "Come on, Lily, if you're going back to the yacht." Lily turned to obey, but as she did so, Mrs. Dorset, who had paused on her way out, moved a few steps back toward the table. "Miss Bart is not going back to the yacht," she said in a voice of singular distinctness. A startled look ran from eye to eye. Mrs. Bry crimsoned to the verge of congestion. Mrs. Stepney slipped nervously behind her husband, and Selden, in the general turmoil of his sensations, was mainly conscious of a longing to grip Dabham by the collar and fling him out into the street. Dorset, meanwhile, had stepped back to his wife's side. His face was white, and he looked about him with cowed, angry eyes. "Bertha. Miss Bart. This is some misunderstanding. Some mistake. Miss Bart remains here," his wife rejoined incisively. "And, I think, George, we had better not detain Mrs. Stepney any longer." Miss Bart, during this brief exchange of words, remained in admirable erectness, slightly isolated from the embarrassed group about her. As he had paled a little under the shock of the insult, but the discomposure of the surrounding faces was not reflected in her own. The faint disdain of her smile seemed to lift her high above her antagonist's reach, and it was not till she had given Mrs. Dorset the full measure of the distance between them that she turned and extended her hand to her hostess. "I am joining the Duchess tomorrow," she explained, "and it seemed easier for me to remain on shore for the night." She held firmly to Mrs. Bry's wavering eye while she gave this explanation, but when it was over, Selden saw her send a tentative glance from one to another of the women's faces. She read their incredulity in their averted looks, and in the mute wretchedness of the men behind them, and for a miserable half-second he thought she quivered on the brink of failure. Then, turning to him with an easy gesture, and the pale bravery of her recovered smile, "Dear Mr. Selden," she said, "you promised to see me to my cab." Outside, the sky was gusty and overcast, and as Lily and Selden moved toward the deserted gardens below the restaurant, spurts of warm rain blew fitfully against their faces. The fiction of the cab had been tacitly abandoned. They walked on in silence, her hand on his arm, till the deeper shade of the gardens received them, and pausing beside a bench, he said, "Colin, sit down a moment." She dropped to the seat without answering, but the electric lamp at the bend of the path shed a gleam on the struggling misery of her face. Selden sat down beside her, waiting for her to speak, fearful lest any word he chose should touch too roughly on her wound, and kept also from free utterance by the wretched doubt which had slowly renewed itself within him. What had brought her to this pass? What weakness had placed her so abominably at her enemy's mercy? And why should Bertha Dorset have turned into an enemy at the very moment when she so obviously needed the support of her sex? Even while his nerves raged at the subjection of husbands to their wives, and at the cruelty of women to their kind, reason obstinately harped on the proverbial relation between smoke and fire. The memory of Mrs. Fisher's hints, and the corroboration of his own impressions, while they deepened his pity, also increased his constraint, since, whichever way he sought a free outlet for sympathy, it was blocked by the fear of committing a blunder. Suddenly it struck him that his silence must seem almost as accusatory as that of the men he had despised for turning from her, but before he could find the fitting word, as he had cut him short with a question, "Do you know of a quiet hotel? I can send for my maid in the morning." "An hotel here that you can go to alone? It's not possible." She met this with a pale gleam of her old playfulness. "What is, then? It's too wet to sleep in the gardens." "But there must be someone to whom I can go. Of course any number, but at this hour? You see, my change of plan was rather sudden. Good God, if you'd listened to me, he cried, venting his helplessness in a burst of anger. She still held him off with the gentle mockery of her smile. Be but haven't I? She rejoined. You advised me to leave the yacht, and I'm leaving it. He saw then, with a pang of self-reproach, that she meant neither to explain nor to defend herself, that by his miserable silence he had forfeited all chance of helping her, and that the decisive hour was past. As he had risen, and stood before him in a kind of clouded majesty, like some deposed princess moving tranquilly to exile. Lily, he exclaimed, with a note of despairing appeal, but H, not now, she gently admonished him, and then, in all the sweetness of her recovered composure, since I must find shelter somewhere, and since you're so kindly here to help me, he gathered himself up at the challenge. Why, you will do as I tell you? There's but one thing, then. You must go straight to your cousins, the Stepneys. Oh, broke from her with a movement of instinctive resistance. But he insisted, come, it's late, and you must appear to have gone there directly. He had drawn her hand into his arm, but she held him back with a last gesture of protest. I can't, not that you don't know Gwen. You mustn't ask me. I must ask you, you must obey me, he persisted, though infected at heart by her own fear. Her voice sank to a whisper, and if she refuses? But, oh, trust me, he could only insist in return, and yielding to his touch, she let him lead her back in silence to the edge of the square. In the cab they continued to remain silent through the brief drive which carried them to the illuminated portals of the Stepneys Hotel. Here he left her outside, in the darkness of the raised hood, while his name was sent up to Stepney, and he paced the showy hall, awaiting the latter's descent. 10 minutes later the two men passed out together between the gold-laced custodians of the threshold, but in the vestibule Stepney drew up with a last flare of reluctance. It's understood, then, he stipulated nervously, with his hand on Selden's arm. As she leaves tomorrow by the early train and my wife's asleep, and can't be disturbed. The blinds of Mrs. Peniston's drawing room were drawn down against the oppressive June sun, and in the sultry twilight the faces of her assembled relatives took on a fitting shadow of bereavement. They were all there. Van Alstyne's, Stepney's, and Melson's, even a stray Peniston or two, indicating, by a greater latitude in dress and manner, the fact of remoter relationship and more settled hopes. The Peniston side was, in fact, secure in the knowledge that the bulk of Mr. Peniston's property went back, while the direct connection hung suspended on the disposal of his widow's private fortune, and on the uncertainty of its extent. Jack Stepney, in his new character as the richest nephew, tacitly took the lead, emphasizing his importance by the deeper gloss of his mourning and the subdued authority of his manner, while his wife's bored attitude and frivolous gown proclaimed the heiress's disregard of the insignificant interests at stake. Old Ned Van Alstyne, seated next to her in a coat that made affliction dapper, twirled his white mustache to conceal the eager twitch of his lips, and Grace Stepney, red-nosed and smelling of crepe, whispered emotionally to Mrs. Herbert Melson, I couldn't bear to see the Niagara anywhere else. A rustle of weeds and quick turning of heads hailed the opening of the door, and Lily Bart appeared, tall and noble in her black dress, with Gertie Farish at her side. The women's faces, as she paused interrogatively on the threshold, were a study in hesitation. One or two made faint motions of recognition, which might have been subdued either by the solemnity of the scene, or by the doubt as to how far the others meant to go. Mrs. Jack Stepney gave a careless nod, and Grace Stepney, with a sepulchral gesture, indicated a seat at her side. But Lily, ignoring the invitation, as well as Jack Stepney's official attempt to direct her, moved across the room with her smooth free gait, and seated herself in a chair which seemed to have been purposely placed apart from the others. It was the first time that S. he had faced her family since her return from Europe, 2 weeks earlier, but if she perceived any uncertainty in their welcome, it served only to add a tinge of irony to the usual composure of her bearing. The shock of dismay with which, on the dock, as he had heard from Gertie Farish of Mrs. Peniston's sudden death, had been mitigated, almost at once, by the irrepressible thought that now, at last, she would be able to pay her debts. As he had looked forward with considerable uneasiness to her first encounter with her aunt, Mrs. Peniston had vehemently opposed her niece's departure with the Dorsets, and had marked her continued disapproval by not writing during Lily's absence. The certainty that as he had heard of the rupture with the Dorsets, made the prospect of the meeting more formidable, and how should Lily have repressed a quick sense of relief at the thought that, instead of undergoing the anticipated ordeal, as he had only to enter gracefully on the long-assured inheritance. It had been, in the consecrated phrase, always understood that Mrs. Peniston was to provide handsomely for her niece, and in the latter's mind the understanding had long since crystallized into fact. She gets everything, of course I don't see what we're here for, Mrs. Jack Stepney remarked with careless loudness to Ned Van Alstyne, and the latter's deprecating murmur Julia was always a just woman might have been interpreted as signifying either acquiescence or doubt. Well, it's only about 400,000, Mrs. Stepney rejoined with a yawn, and Grace Stepney, in the silence produced by the lawyer's preliminary cough, was heard to sob out colon they won't find a towel missing I went over them with her the very day, Lily, oppressed by the close atmosphere, and the stifling odor of fresh morning, felt her attention straying as Mrs. Peniston's lawyer, solemnly erect behind the bull table at the end of the room, began to rattle through the preamble of the will. It's like being in church, she reflected, wondering vaguely where Gwen Stepney had got such an awful hat. Then she noticed how stout Jack had grown he would soon be almost as plethoric as Herbert Melson, who sat a few feet off, breathing puffily as he leaned his black-gloved hands on his stick. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.